Thanks, David, and thanks so much to all of you for coming out this evening. Really glad to see so many people here, and we're looking forward to spending some time together. This is a topic that statistically will touch almost every person's life in one way or another during the course of your life. One in every two men and one in every three women in this room will be struck with cancer if the statistics that are currently accurate hold up. Probably one in four of us will die from some type of cancer. So this is a disease that affects all of us and is one that we do well to try to understand. My qualifications for talking about this subject are sort of varied. I'm a lecturer in the Department of Biology at Indiana University. I've been doing this for about 18 years. So this is a subject I have an academic interest in. I teach pre-medical students, taught about cancer for years. Also, as the pastor of this congregation, I've had opportunity to minister to people struggling with cancer or with loved ones who have cancer, and so have had experience and interest in that regard as well. Both of my parents have survived bouts with cancer. My maternal grandmother died from ovarian cancer, so I've experienced it as a family member and as a loved one. And then finally, 2 years ago, I went to my doctor for my annual checkup and just ran some blood work. We thought everything was fine, had a nice visit. The next morning, I was speaking at my children's school, and I got a call from the doctor saying that he'd made an appointment at the oncologist and I needed to go there right away. Completely unexpected. I went to go see the oncologist and he noted my white blood cell count was about 10 times normal. He did a few more tests, but he told me he's pretty sure I had a type of leukemia. So I was told as a 47-year-old that I had cancer. I've not been sick much of my life, not spent much time with doctors. I've been in good physical health and I've kept myself in shape. It was a pretty big shock to me, probably because of these five women that I am responsible for, my wife Amy, daughters Maggie, Grace, Anne, and Jane. Jane was 4 years old at the time. I thought to myself, this can't be happening. I don't have time for this. This isn't the right time for something like this to happen, but it did. And so I went from having an academic interest in cancer to having a very personal interest in cancer, and I could wish that I knew less about cancer, but my experiences over the last couple of years have taught me a lot. My plan in this talk is to talk a little bit about the biology of cancer. I think some general information could be useful. Then I'll talk about my particular experience with cancer and then draw lessons that I've learned and things that have helped me in dealing with this. And let me say up front, I'm well aware that people in this audience have experienced much more severe types of cancer than I have. I know some of you have lost loved ones to cancer, so I am not holding myself up as the worst case scenario at all. I know that that people's struggles can be far worse than what I've had to deal with, but I do think I've learned some things that will be useful for us to think about together as we spend some time this evening. So what I'll do is start by talking about some general information about cancer. So you can get a lot of good information on the internet. The NIH has a lot of material there. Cancer, just defining it, cancer is a term used for diseases in which abnormal cells divide without control and are able to invade other tissues. Cancer cells can also spread to other parts of the body through the blood and the lymph system. So two properties of cancerous cells, they're growing, dividing when they're not supposed to be. And then the second one is that they leave the primary site where they're supposed to be found, and they spread to other parts of the body. And that part of that spreading is usually what's lethal. 90% of cancer deaths are caused when the cancer spreads to a new area. So just as an example here, you see here is a lining, a sheet of cells, a layer of cells lining the colon. All right, so if you get a single cell that begins to divide out of control, it starts to produce daughter cells in purple here. And so the rapidly dividing cells begin to proliferate. They may start to pile up and form a mass. Most normal cells, when they bump up against other cells, they stop dividing. That's the way they're made. They're not meant to form these lumps. Cancerous cells form these lumps. And then you see here, eventually you can get invasion of other tissue breaking away from the primary side of the tumor. And then if you get into the bloodstream or into the lymphatic system that hooks up all your lymph nodes, now the cancer cells have access to the rest of your body, and they go and they colonize new areas of the body. And as I said before, that's often what makes cancer so lethal. So we might ask, why are there so many different kinds of cancer? Because cancer is a disease of the cells, it's really not just one disease. It's many diseases. In fact, there's more than 100 different types of cancer, and most of these cancers are named for the organ or the type of cell in which they originate. So there's a lot of different varieties. In terms of prevalence, cancers that start in nervous tissue, brain or supporting tissues in the brain, are relatively small amount, but they can be obviously very devastating because it's hard to operate on tumors in the brain. Leukemias, this is what I have, cancers of the bloodstream, about 3%. Lymphomas, cancers that are targeted in the lymph nodes, about 4%. Sarcomas are cancers that attack bone, fat, or muscle tissue. These are fairly rare, but are very difficult to treat oftentimes. And then by far the most common types of cancers are called carcinomas. And these are cancers that start in these cells that exist in layers that line your organs. Your skin is a sheet of cells. So your skin, the linings of your organ. And so you see the more popular cancers here: lung, breast cancer, colon cancer, and prostate cancer. So how common is this? I said the stats are that 1 in 2 men and 1 in 3 women will get cancer at some point in their lives. In the U.S., estimated number of new cases this year will be about 1.6 million. You can see for men, the prostate is by far the most common. Then you have lung and colon. For women, it's breast, lung, and colon. So the four most common cancers are carcinomas of the prostate, breast, lung, and colon. And that's where most of them start. Cancer is very deadly in addition to being very prevalent. It's the second leading cause of death worldwide and also in the United States. Currently, we estimate about 8.2 million cancer deaths a year worldwide. In the U.S., there should be about 585,000 next year, in this coming year, is what they're predicting. And you can see from this table that the cancers are not equally lethal. So in this number of nearly 600,000 expected deaths, you see that lung cancer, while it only makes up about 14% of the cancer incidence, is by far the most deadly cancer. And it does remind us that not all cancers are equally deadly. Part of the issue is cancers in certain organs have much better access to the bloodstream, can spread more easily, and so some of them are far more deadly than others. All right, so one of the questions that comes up often, and if you've had a relative that's had cancer, or even if you've struggled with it, you know one of the problems is you can be treating a cancer, everything seems to be going well, the cancer responds, and then over time the cancer stops responding. What's going on? One of the things to understand is that cancers, because they start from a single cell, usually what happens is the cell accumulates multiple mutations that sort of unregulate the processes of cell division. The cell starts growing out of control. Because we're multicellular organisms, it only works if all the cells, you know, do what they're supposed to do. If one of the cells decides, you know what, I'm going to do my own thing, it causes a lot of problems. And so what happens is, if a cell starts to divide when it's not supposed to, it has an advantage over its neighbors in that it's going to reproduce itself. See, most normal cells, they divide a set number of times, they stop dividing, and then they just do their job. Well, here our cell keeps continuing to divide, it's starting to proliferate and spread, and then within the cell that's dividing, you may get an additional mutation, an additional genetic change that makes that cell even more aggressive. So within the tumor itself, you may have more aggressive cells developing. So that's what this diagram is showing. Here are the cells in orange. This one begins to proliferate more rapidly. Another variation occurs to one of the cells within the tumor, and now we've got this red-colored cell. And so over time, what's happening is the most aggressive variant of the tumor dominates the tumor and begins to take over. And so this is why, you know, your cancer may be responding to treatment, but one of these cells acquires new mutations that actually give it drug resistance. And this is why fighting cancer sometimes is a very frustrating process. Now, one of the things that, because of the way cancers start, it affects when we are most likely to get cancer. So most cancers require the accumulation of multiple mutations in the same cell. And so there seems to be kind of this threshold before a cancer starts to appear. So this little graph is showing annual death rate for cancers versus years of age. And the point of this is that as you go along, cancer death rates are very low until you get to about age, 55. And then 55 to the end of life, the rates are just shooting up through the roof. And in fact, 75% of cancers are diagnosed in people who are over 55 years of age. Now, obviously, there are exceptions to that. I'm an exception to that. But far and away, most of the cancers come in our later years. And some people have said, if you live long enough, you'll eventually get some type of cancer. So what causes cancer? There's a lot of different things that can lead to cancer. Some external agents like chemicals, radiation, your diet. Some biological agents like viruses or bacteria. Even some internal factors like your heredity can be a part of this. Let's talk about some of the different classes of things that can lead to cancer. So there's a whole class of agents that are called tumor initiators or carcinogens. These are things that actually induce mutations. So these things will increase the likelihood of a particular cell gaining mutation that cause it to grow out of control. Some examples of these types of things, cigarette smoke. The number one link to cancer is cigarette smoke. There's over two dozen carcinogens in cigarette smoke. So again, it's not that cigarettes cause cancer, it's that they increase the likelihood that a mutation is going to happen that's going to lead to cancer. Radiation can induce mutations. Tanning. My children tell me, don't stand up in front of people and tell them after you come back from Florida not to tan. I do use sunscreen, and I'll say more about that later, but I don't use tanning beds. And in fact, this is one of the reasons why we're starting to see regulation of tanning beds. Very dangerous because you're just hitting your body with high levels of radiation, and radiation causes mutations. The other class of agents are called tumor promoters. And so these are things that promote cell division without actually disrupting the DNA. So an example of this, estrogen. So women who are on hormone replacement therapy, estrogen is a tumor promoter. It encourages cell division. Now, normally that's not a problem, but women who've had a history of cancer are nowadays not encouraged to be on hormone replacement therapy because of the fact that that promotes cell division. Now, my family had the opportunity to go to Northern Ireland last summer, and we were living just a little bit away from the Bushmills Distillery, which is about 350 years old. And I had to, when I gave this talk over there, apologize and tell them I wasn't trying to run down the local economy. But the fact is that hard alcohol acts as a tumor promoter. Now, this is not obvious how this works. What happens is, because it kills cells that line the esophagus, the body then has to replace those cells. So you get sort of as a secondary effect, cell division going on in the esophagus after drinking. This is why the combination of drinking and smoking is one of the worst things that you can do. I had people back when I was in college tell me, well, I only smoke when I drink. By which I guess they meant, they weren't smoking six packs a day. But this is very dangerous. In fact, the odds of getting cancer, when you do these two things together, is about 40 times higher than people who don't do that. So just be aware that there are certain things in our environment that can promote cancer. All right, there are also some biological agents. There are some viruses and also a bacterium. So H. pylori is the bacterium that causes ulcers. It's been associated with stomach cancer. There are some cancers caused by viruses, including liver cancer and cervical carcinoma. So the HPV virus is linked 100% of the time to cervical cancer. There's now a vaccine available against the HPV virus. So there are some biological agents. These are fairly rare, but they can promote cancer. In addition, it is possible to inherit mutations from your parents, so there are heritable risks for cancer. This does not amount to a large percentage of the cases, but it is significant. This is actress Angelina Jolie, who last year had radical surgery to head off the possibility of getting cancer. She found out she inherited a particular mutation that raises the prospects of her getting breast cancer to over 80% over the course of her lifetime, ovarian cancer over 50% with this one particular mutation. So she took a radical step to try to prevent that from happening. So we might ask then, given what we know, can we avoid getting cancer? Well, sure, there are some things that we should do to try to minimize exposure to things that we know are connected to cancer. So certainly, if you can give up smoking or limit it, that's probably the number one thing you could do. Using sunscreen is a good idea. It's not a good idea to go out and get roasted because it's just radiating your skin. So there are some things you can do, but these things in themselves will not be sufficient. And I want to make sure that nobody here goes away thinking that I'm saying if you get cancer, it's because you somehow deserved it because you weren't taking the proper precautions. That's not true at all. At the bottom line, we're not going to be able to prevent ourselves from getting cancer. Just read in the last 2 weeks, a famous neurosurgeon at Stanford University, 36 years old, never smoked a cigarette in his life, just died from metastatic lung cancer. Okay, so you can take all the right steps and you won't be able to prevent it. Which so as a connected idea here, don't make it the obsession of your life not to get cancer. You know, the guy says it's one in two men. I'm going to be one of the ones that doesn't get it. If you make that the obsession of your life, you will be greatly frustrated. So don't do that. Okay, so one of the things that's been a huge improvement in the last several decades with treating cancer is early detection. This is the best indicator of success in treating a cancer is identifying it early on. So there are certain suggested tests that we are supposed to be getting. You know, when you get to 50 years age, start doing colonoscopies, men to have PSA screening, women to have mammograms and things like that. So there's a schedule. It's good to do that. Of course, if you have a family history of cancer, you should talk to your doctor because he might recommend or she might recommend that you begin your screenings earlier. Sometimes that's important. This is an important thing to do because early detection helps in the treatment tremendously. All right, well, how is it actually treated if we get it? There's a couple of different strategies, and for many people, their treatment involves a whole combination of a number of these different things. So I'll just talk about these briefly. So the first one is surgery. You see, if a cancer is localized and it's in a place that's operable, very effective treatment. If you can get to it, to cut it out and to remove it. Okay, that has a lot of upside. Okay, it's obviously very limited. If the cancer is spread, it won't work. And if the cancer is in an area you can't get to surgically, and often this happens in brain tumors, that the surgery is limited. But if you're able to remove the cancer, that's a tremendously effective way to go. The second approach is radiation. So here you see we've now gotten able to really aim our radiation a lot more precisely. The radiation goes in and can zap cells that are inside the body that are not easy to get to with a knife. There are an upside to this. One of the members of our congregation was diagnosed with cancer of the tonsils back about the same time I got my diagnosis. Now you think, tonsils, that's great. You know, we all know you can do tonsil surgery, right? So that's what they started with. They removed the tonsils. But the cancer had already spread into some adjoining lymph nodes. All right, now getting in there around the esophagus and taking out lymph nodes, that gets a little more tricky. So for that, they use radiation. And it was very effective. It seems to have been very effective. The problem is, though, there's collateral damage when you do radiation. So he burned up his esophagus. He had to be fed through a feeding tube for about half of a year. After that, you know, now he is in good shape. He's made a recovery, but he can't taste anything. And his salivary glands don't work very well. And so there's lasting side damage because of the radiation. But it can be an effective treatment. They think they got his cancer. Okay, chemotherapy is another common treatment. And most of us would know people who have been through this. Here's an infusion center. They put you in a recliner. They hook you up to an IV. And then you sit there. And the chemicals go in. And you have to do chemotherapy when the cancer spread or when it's a blood system cancer, because this is the only treatment we have that puts medicine throughout the whole body. Now, the problem, chemotherapy can be very effective. The problem with it is it's typically not directed, right? Chemotherapy works on the idea that you kill all rapidly dividing cells. And the chemotherapeutic agents aren't able to distinguish between rapidly dividing cancer cells and rapidly dividing healthy cells. And so this is a type of carpet bombing kind of a strategy where you can take out the cancer, but there's also a lot of collateral damage. Immune system is often suppressed. Lining of the intestine, it makes people very sick. Your hair often will fall out. Hair follicles, that's often the least of our worries, but it's why chemotherapy causes us to often lose our hair. All right, so some of the newer developments, though, that often will be delivered in this same way through an infusion center are these targeted molecular therapies. Well, now companies are engineering molecules that go into and precisely interfere with a pathway in a particular cancer or a particular cancer cell. And so these have far fewer side effects, and there have been some really exciting developments in this area. We're just on the threshold, I think, of learning more about how those work. And then finally, and there are other things we could list here, but one of the things that's been very effective, especially in treating children with leukemia, are bone marrow transplants. You can actually replace the bone marrow and, in essence, give a new immune system to a person who's struggling with cancer. And these have been very effective and life-saving treatments. Not simple. A high rate of death from doing stem cell transplants. So it's not an easy fix, but it's one that does have great potential. So if we look, you know, taking all this together, how successful have we been at treating cancer? Just look at this top line. So this is the trends in 5-year relative cancer survival rate. So this is one of the things I talk about. So if you were diagnosed with cancer, how many of those people diagnosed are still alive in 5 years? And what this says is that back in the 70s, for all sites, it was about 49%, less than half. Today, we're up close to 70%. That's tremendous improvement. What that shows is that early detection, new treatments are extending people's lives. So people are living longer with cancer. Some of these cancers have been very stubborn to improvements. Look at lung cancer, still not very good. Pancreatic cancer, still not very good. But in some of the cancers, there have been tremendous improvement. But given that fact, this is very fascinating. I know you can't read this. Let me just try to explain. These are graphs that show relative. The scales are different here. But the rates of death per 100,000 of the population and the year, and it compares heart disease in the red line and cancer in the blue line. Now, on the left here is when the person is dying younger than 85 years. So in everyone but the really elderly folks, what this is showing is that the improvement we've made in cancer is not much compared to the improvement we've made in treating heart disease. We've had much more success at treating heart disease. And if you look at the older population, you see that this difference is hardly, we've hardly made a difference from the cancer standpoint, but heart disease, we've made a significant difference. So just the point of that is, despite all the progress we've made, we're a long way from being rid of cancer. And when people talk about, you know, people usually trying to raise money for this, talk about finding the cure for cancer, that really is it's like looking for a unicorn or something, because there's so many different types of cancers. There's not going to be one cure for cancer. But as we've seen, we're making more or less progress in treating different types of cancer. All right, so I can share a little bit about what chemotherapy is actually like, again, having gone through it. I would have rather just to tell you what I hear it's like, but I can tell you what it's actually like. I began chemotherapy about 7 months after I was diagnosed with cancer. The type of leukemia I have progresses more slowly, so initially doctors wanted to just wait and see how I was doing. After about 7 months, it became clear I needed to be treated. I went into the doctor on Monday. He said, okay, we're going to start treatment. On Tuesday, I went and had surgery and had a central line, a port, put into my chest. So it's, I just had it taken out a few weeks ago, and I asked Dr. Haddad if I could keep it, and he said, no, they're not allowed to give you medical devices. So the best I could get was a picture of it. So it's a stainless steel reservoir with kind of a gel top. It was right under my skin here in my chest. And what that allows them to do is to put a needle right into your chest, okay, and it doesn't have to go into your arm. Then, as they're giving the drugs, they go through this tube, and this tube was under my skin and went up over my collarbone into a vein and dropped all the way down just above my heart. And I saw it on an x-ray. I was surprised when I saw it. I had no idea it was that long. So that's what that device was. So that was put in on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, I went to get my first treatment. So they hooked me up to the machines, and I received two of these harsh chemotherapeutic agents that are just killing all dividing cells, and then one of the targeted therapies. Okay, and it turns out the targeted therapy is complicated to put in because your body sees it as a pathogen and wants to fight against it, so you have an immune reaction to it. So they told me, you know, this might happen. Here we're going to give you some medication to sort of tamp down your immune system. So they gave me IV Benadryl. Now, you think you get sleepy if you take a Benadryl pill, try putting it directly into your bloodstream. Okay, so I was very groggy. And then they started putting in this medicine, and it had to be put in very, very slowly. And I spiked a fever. I went into convulsions. The nurse said, it's okay, we've seen this before. I said, that may make you feel better. But she knew what to do. That was a good thing. So there's another drug I got that really just knocked me out. It took 8 hours that day, sitting in a chair, to get the medicine in. Come back the next day, I don't have to have the targeted therapy, so it was only 4 hours. I do that again on the third day. Now it's Friday. I go home, and I start to not feel so good. I think that you were over for dinner, David, that night, and I was like, okay, I think I'm done here. But I went to bed, and I didn't get up really till Monday. You are bloated from taking all this liquid in, constipated, dizzy and nauseous. You can't lift your head up. And when I was about on Sunday, I said, I can't do this. I cannot do this for 6 months. This is how long this is supposed to last. It's not going to happen. But by Monday afternoon, I started to feel better. And so I realized, okay, I'm not going to feel this bad the entire month. And in fact, after about midway through the next week, I started to bounce back. And I thought, okay, well, if I know that this is only going to be really bad for about 3 or 4 days, that's a different story. And that was a big help understanding how this is going to work. So I did that procedure for over the course of 6 months and had these treatments and finished that up last April. Now, the reason I started treatment was because I had an unusual complication, meaning this is something that the cancer caused, but is not something that this type of cancer always causes. So CLL, that's what I have, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, is a cancer of white blood cells in which an immature white cell in the bone marrow begins to divide out of control. And as that cell divides out of control, the cancer cell then spread to the blood, the lymph nodes, the spleen, and they crowd out the healthy cells of the blood. So what happens is your bone marrow can't make healthy red blood cells. My hemoglobin dropped to about half of what it should have been. And that'd be like taking out half your blood and try to function. And my immune system was suppressed because the white blood cells being made are not functional ones. And then on top of that, the cancer got into the pleural space around my lungs. So the space not in my lungs but around the outside of my lungs irritated it, and I started to accumulate fluid around especially my right lung. I noticed this because when I laid down, I couldn't breathe very well. Something's wrong here. We went on and on and on. Finally, they did a chest x-ray and found I had a lot of fluid there. So the way we dealt with that was I went to a pulmonologist. They put a needle in my back, put a catheter in my back, hit the fluid, right, not the lung, and draw out the fluid. First time we did that, I blacked out. I was not knowing what to expect. About the 10th time I did it, I was a pro. This was the record, and I know there's at least one doctor in here who does this procedure, and he would be very upset with my pulmonologist for taking out 2.5 liters of fluid in one go came out of my body. So that was creating a lot of extra problems for me, and that's why we started the treatment. Thankfully, after the 10th time I was drained, I haven't had to have that happen again, so I'm very grateful for that. So let me say a little bit more about chronic leukemias. Chronic leukemias grow more slowly than acute leukemias, but can be harder to cure. So the leukemias that strike children are acute leukemias, and they come on much more rapidly, they're much more aggressive, but they're also easier to treat. The cells are more responsive to treatment. So there's an upside and a downside. The kind of cancer I have doesn't come on as rapidly, but because it's slower growing, it's very hard to get rid of. It does not respond as well to treatment. So within the different types of CLLs, there are faster and slower growing varieties. And I have one of the faster growing types of chronic leukemias. And because I got this at a young age, the doctors weren't really surprised when they found that out. So what's my prognosis? The subtype I have has a median survival rate of 6 to 9 years, and that's the most recent data, and it's several years old. One of the things that you'll learn if you deal with doctors is they're not going to be pinned down on how much time you have. Absolutely will not be pinned down. And one of the reasons is there's a lot of variability in that, and I think they frankly just don't know. And for anyone who struggles with cancer, you realize this creates a very complicated situation where they're telling you your life is going to be cut short, but nobody can tell you exactly how short. And so, you get this conflict. Do I just go on or do I not go on? Do I prepare to die? What do I do? I'll say more about how I've tried to deal with that sort of uncertainty that comes with that. So CLL, the disease I have, is considered incurable. Right? If you go look it up, that's what they'll say. It's an incurable blood cancer. But new treatments are always in development. So the American Society for Clinical Oncology just published in February of this year, named CLL the cancer of the year for last year because of 4 new targeted therapies that were came on the market just last year. So the only point here is that time is the longer you can hang around, the more opportunity there is for new treatments and new developments. I've been told that because of my age, that's the one thing nobody knows, is how any of these treatments will last over time, that I should be thinking about a bone marrow transplant as a possible longer-term solution. So what is my current situation? After 6 months of chemotherapy, my CLL is in remission, which means not that the cancer is gone. It's still detectable in my blood, but I'm not experiencing symptoms right now. The treatment knocked it down to a very low level. I was able to go and enjoy my oldest daughter's graduation from high school just at the end of my treatment, and had a wonderful experience there. I feel better than I have in a couple of years, but the doctors tell me that the cancer will come back. It's only a matter of time. Could be months, could be years. So you live with that uncertainty, and then they say when it does come back, then we have to figure out what the best treatment option is at that time. So as I've tried to deal with the reality of this situation, I've thought about what are the particular challenges, and I'm thinking what things that I've seen as challenges, and then we'll talk also about some of the things that have been helpful. So some of the challenges, and this I think, you know, whether you have cancer or a loved one, a friend has cancer, this is worth thinking about and understanding. First of all is just physical suffering. Both the diseases but also the treatments can be tremendously difficult physically. And there's a sense of just degradation that happens as your body is suffering and you lose you lose your health even sometimes from the treatment. And so there's tremendous challenges that are created by just the physical aspects of cancer and its treatment. There are also emotional challenges as well. Fear and anxiety, just about the uncertainty, like I said earlier, you know, and am I supposed to get my effects in order and plan for the end, or am I supposed to keep living my life? There's just, you don't know what exactly to expect sometimes. I think for me personally, fear has been the greatest challenge that I've had. I had a very strange experience. A couple weeks ago, I went to visit a friend, and I was staying in his guest bedroom, and it turned out this is the same place I stayed the night that I was diagnosed with leukemia. I had an out-of-town meeting. I went to the oncologist in the morning, went and stayed with this friend. I'm in that same room, and I was remembering how utterly terrified I was. They, you know, sent me off to this meeting with, "You have cancer." And so the fear comes in many forms. One is just simply the process of dying. And this is one of the places where, you know, my scientific training, I know, I read enough to know what's going to happen, what typically happens. Treatment works for a while, cancer comes back. We try a different treatment, cancer comes back. You just go back and forth through these different treatments. Eventually you run out of options. And then most likely, you'll die from an opportunistic infection because you don't have a functional immune system. That's what the future holds potentially for me. And there's fear associated with that. There's also a fear that comes with losing control of your life. You know, I spent more time in doctor's offices in the last 2 years than I had my entire life put together. You lose control of your schedule. You lose control of when you feel good and when you don't. There's a lot of things you lose control of. I think other fears that we have are financial fears. You know, how is this going to be paid for? I have probably for me the greatest fear that I've had to deal with is what's going to happen to my wife and my children. I have young children, and nobody's children should have to grow up without a father. And yet that's a prospect that my family faces. And that is a real fear for me and a source of anxiety. I think there's also a fear there that just in some way going through this process that I might somehow dishonor my family or dishonor God. And so there's a lot of challenges that come in with that. I think other emotions and struggles that people have are anger. You know, anger with the fact that, you know, I've done everything right and I have cancer and, you know, these people over here don't have cancer. Or anger with God. Why has this happened to me? Confusion. There's a one level of confusion that just happens because of all the you're being bombarded with medical information and just understanding what's happening. But there's also the confusion that comes with why. Why is this happening? Why would God allow this to happen? Some people struggle with depression, and there's a real sorrow. And especially if you have a diagnosis that's terminal, you know, that there really isn't hope that you're going to recover. So how do you not just quit and say, I'm giving up and I'm quitting? And that's a challenge that people have. Another one, and this is not one I would have immediately thought of, but I have seen people who become obsessed. And so cancer defines their life. When I was in for treatment one time, doctor had me meet a woman who had a cancer similar to me. And so we're talking about it, and she's on this blog and on that blog, and she is interacting with all this community of people with this type of leukemia. And after 10 minutes talking to her, I said, I can't do this. I cannot do this. Some information is useful, but I cannot let my entire life be defined by this disease. And that's something that sometimes happens to people. Now, all of these things are normal, I would say. They're not healthy, but they're normal. And so we need to think about how to deal with them. So what has given me the greatest help in dealing with this? Well, I do think there's a place for good information. So you want to go to good doctors, you want to get good information about your disease, treatment options, things like that. One of the challenges people have is understanding everything. So I started writing out a list of questions that I wanted to ask my doctor before I went in there, because what always happens is the doctor comes in and he's doing his thing, and then before you know it, the doctor's saying, okay, is there anything else? And you're like, oh, no, there's nothing else. And then as soon as the doctor leaves, you think, well, there was 15 things I wanted to ask the doctor. So I write them down. I often will take somebody with me to doctor's appointments, so I have another set of ears to help me hear what the doctor's saying. I've been blessed with some doctors who actually answer emails, so I've been able to ask questions even when I'm not there. And that's been very helpful. Talking to people. One of the most helpful things that happened to me early on was I had friends of mine just say, we want to meet with you. And to just sit and talk and even cry together, that just meant so much. I've given this talk before, and people come up to me afterwards and said, I don't know what to say. You know, I've got this friend that has cancer. I don't know what to say. Disabuse yourself of the idea that anything you say could fix the problem. Okay, you got to get rid of that right away. And then you realize it's not about what you say. It's about being a friend, being there. The thing that helped me was people saying, we're with you in this. We are going to be with you in this. And that is a very powerful help to somebody who's dealing with this. You don't have to have the answers. You just have to be a friend to listen to them and to tell them that you're with them. I think letting people help. Early on in this process, one of my cousins who survived lymphoma was talking to me, and she said, you have to let people help you. Let people help you. That goes against my nature. I want to do everything for myself. I feel like I'm self-sufficient. And so I had to make a conscious decision, you know, to let people help in certain areas. And it turned out to be a tremendous blessing for me, but also a blessing to the people who helped me. And I can't even begin to tell you how members of this congregation who watched our kids and who brought us meals and who offered to drive us to doctor's appointments and do all kinds of things for us, what a tremendous help that's been in our dealing with the challenges of this disease. Another thing, and I think this helped me deal with this kind of a tendency toward obsession, was to try to do as much as I could. Now, obviously, depending on your cancer, depending on your treatment, you may or may not be able to do much. By God's grace, I was able to work. I had to miss some work, but I was able to keep working through the treatment. I did that. I'm an athlete. I got to the point where my hemoglobin was about 8.5, which, as I said, is about half of normal. And I couldn't go up a flight of stairs without having to stop and catch my breath. But I said, I'm going to keep exercising. So I got on the treadmill. You know, it was ridiculous and embarrassing. It's why I didn't run outside. I didn't want anyone to see me. I was on the treadmill. But, you know, you walk for a while. You jog for a while. You walk. You do what you can. And I never quit. Because, again, to the extent that I was able, I tried to keep my life normal. And my wife and I both agreed to try to do this also as a way to help our kids deal with the situation. I think another thing that's been tremendously helpful is the support that others have shown for my family. Any caregiver here who's had to see a loved one deal with this can tell you that it's probably harder to be the caregiver than the patient. And I think my wife, Amy, has had to deal with a lot more in terms of anxiety than I've had to. And so when people have come alongside my family and helped them, it's been tremendously encouraging. We had one of our relatives called one time just to talk to one of my daughters. Didn't talk to me or Amy, which would be very unusual. Just talked to one of my daughters just to find out how she was doing and to pray with her. And that really meant a lot to us. And I should say, too, that one of the greatest ways that this has manifested itself is in the prayers. I have people telling me they're praying for me, you know, all over the world even. This town, other towns, all over the world. The body of Christ is such an amazing thing. And so praying and letting people know that you're praying for them is a tremendous, tremendous help. Well, all these things have helped me tremendously, but none of them has helped me as much as my relationship with God. I grew up going to church, so I knew about God, but I did not know God. And I was a person who could fix whatever was going wrong. I had a lot of talents, and I went off to a very prestigious university in this country, and finally came up against some things I couldn't fix and began to realize that I didn't have it all together like I thought I did. In fact, I realized that I was a morally flawed person. And it was in that context that someone who lived near me introduced me to Jesus Christ. I felt like I met the person of Jesus Christ for the first time when I was in college and realized that here was someone who had come to die and take away my sins, all my failings, and to give me new life. This verse is particularly meaningful to me. I've come that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly. Promise from Jesus. And that was something I didn't have and something that I desperately needed. And so as God worked in my life, I came to the point of seeing that Jesus was indeed the one in whom I should put my faith. And I trusted in him and began to have a relationship with God and to experience this abundant life. It's not abundant physical life. See, that's one of the problems that if you get your Christianity from TV, you're going to think that everything should be good in your life then and easy. And that's not what this abundant life is about at all. It's about having a type of life that can't be touched by things like cancer and other forms of suffering. And that's what I finally began to understand when I was back as a college student. So Jesus says here, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. And this idea right here is at the core of how I am dealing with having a cancer diagnosis. That Jesus Christ says that if we have put our faith in him, though we die, yet will we live. That there is a life that will go on after our lives in this world. And that's absolutely central to the way I've dealt with this cancer diagnosis, is having confidence that this life is not the end of my life. And so what's happened is it's changed my perspective. Having a relationship with God through Jesus Christ has helped me understand that having cancer is not an accident. It's just not some weird thing that's happened. It's a part of God's plan. It's a part of God's plan for me. And I also know that having cancer is an opportunity for me to know God better and to glorify God. And so beating cancer takes on a whole new meaning. Beating cancer is not living beyond this cancer so I can die from something else, right? Because we're all going to die of something. Beating cancer is honoring God while I have cancer, whether it takes my life or not. It's a different perspective. It also means I don't have to be afraid of the process of death or dying. Jesus Christ has died, and he's taken the sting out of death, the Bible tells us. And because he lives, I have confidence that I also will live after I die. It also means that I don't have to be afraid, ultimately, of what's going to happen to my family. I've come to terms with the idea that God loves my family more than I do. And he knows what they need more than I do. And I have a particular idea about what they need, but God has his own idea, which I trust is far better than mine. In fact, I can actually say that I've seen how God has used this cancer for good in my life. Let me make it clear. I'm not saying cancer is good. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying I've seen how he's used it for good in my life. He's shown me that I'm not really in control of my life. There's an illusion that we control a lot more than we actually do. That we're calling the shots, not God. And this has helped me realize again that it's God's world and that I am not the one running the world. It's also helped me come to terms with the fact that I really am mortal and I need to be prepared for death. One of the fascinating things, if you read about cancer, what people are going to say is the key to beating it is to have a positive attitude. So you can't talk about death as a possibility, right? Because that would be bringing negative thoughts into the equation. And if you do that, you're missing a tremendous opportunity, because the fact is we are all going to die. And we all do need to come to terms with what that means. And having a diagnosis of a terminal disease forces this upon you. I'm just like the next person. I'd much rather shove this into the background and not think about it. But I can't do that. And that's been tremendously helpful for me, actually, to have that perspective. David says in Psalm 39, "Lord, make me know my end and what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am." There's something profound about that, that when we understand the limited nature of our life, it changes a lot. I found now I'm thankful for every day that I feel well in a way I never was before. You just take that for granted. But, you know, your perspective changes when you're confronted with this. I really do need the support and love of other people. Okay? You know, that sounds like a radical idea. But this has been brought home. It's just so clearly to me how the love that people have extended to us and how that has been such a blessing. College friends I haven't talked to in years that I'm back in touch with because of this disease, and it's just been a tremendous encouragement to me that the relationships matter. The Bible is more meaningful to me than it's ever been. When I was first diagnosed, I was reading in the first book of Psalms, the beginning of the book of Psalms. There's a lot of Psalms of lament in there. I never understood those things. I didn't like to read them. I just whizzed through them. It was amazing. Reading those Psalms in the context of a cancer diagnosis is like I was seeing something I'd never seen before. That God actually gives us the words to cry out to him in lament and in sorrow. And what an incredible gift that was to be able to in a real spirit of lament, sing and read the Psalms of lament. So it's been a tremendous help to me, and has ultimately helped me see that I need my Savior more than ever. I am mortal. I can't do it. I need the Lord Jesus. Paul says it well. He says, quoting Jesus here, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." And then Paul says, after quoting Jesus here, "Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." How are you going to be strong for a loved one who needs you when they go through this disease? How are you going to be strong yourself going through something like this? Paul says you're not going to do it by grabbing yourself by the bootstraps and doing it on your own. He's saying you're going to be strong in the strength that comes from Jesus Christ. And isn't that the amazing irony? Jesus Christ came from heaven and made himself weak, helpless, and died. And then he defeated death and rose from the dead and now is strong. And because he became weak for people who truly are weak, you and me, now we can have his strength at work in us. And so I don't want to depend on my own strength. I want to depend on the strength that he gives those who are weak in him. I told you earlier, the doctor told me, one of my doctors said, you really need to get your mind around the fact that at some point you're probably going to have a bone marrow transplant. So I got educated about bone marrow transplants. They said you'll be off work for a year. If you survive, 20 to 30% of people won't even survive the procedure. After a year, the cancer may come back. Even if you survive the treatment, there's no guarantee the cancer won't come back. So I'm thinking, well, I can't deal with that. And I can't. And thankfully, right now, I don't need to. But I'm absolutely confident, based on what the Bible tells me, that if that is indeed what I have to go through, that when I need that grace, I'll have it. If that's what I need to go through, he will give me the strength to deal with what I need when it happens. And that's where my hope is. Well, Jesus says in the Gospel of Matthew, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. I don't know what burdens you're carrying tonight as you come here. It may have something to do with cancer, may have nothing to do with cancer, but I know that most of us are carrying burdens. And Jesus says, give those burdens to me, and I will give you rest. The promise of rest. And he's not talking here about a temporal, short-lived rest, but a permanent rest. He says in another place, in the world you will have trouble, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. And I'm absolutely confident that if you come to Jesus Christ with your burdens, he will give you a rest that cancer or whatever else it is that is your burden cannot touch and cannot take away. That's ultimately what's helped me deal with this situation. And I recommend it to you. That is my hope and prayer for each one of you, that you would know that rest and that peace that comes through Jesus Christ. And with that, I think I'll finish my talk. I'll put up one more slide that just has some references that I found helpful. Thank you very much for coming.